on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Welcome back. Today is Friday, March 25th. I'm Eva Uguensenge.
And I'm Sam Moore. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscasts and podcasts on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:09 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
To start the show, we have News 101 co-director Emily Blake's interview with Aaron Goodman, a professor at Kwantlen Polytechnic University in communication and journalism. He discusses his photographic documentary following three long-term heroin users in Vancouver over a year as they participate in North America's first heroin-assisted treatment program.
Following that, we have News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph's interview with Cody Zachariah, chairman of the National Aboriginal Caucus for the Canadian Federation of Students. Rohit spoke with Cody about Trudeau's budget reveal and the government's failure to lift the 2% funding cap on the post-secondary student support program for First Nations.
To finish off our show, we have a panel discussion on the Gian Gomeshi verdict.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC faculty holds vote of no confidence in Board of Governors. The Faculty Association held a special meeting Tuesday to discuss and vote on the motion. The motion states, quote, "Be it resolved that the Faculty Association of the University of British Columbia has no confidence in the British Columbia Board of Governors." The vote followed a petition signed by more than 450 faculty members. UBC Vice President of External Relations, Phil Steenkamp, says the vote will not be legally binding on UBC. Associate Professor of Philosophy, Jonathan Ichikawa, is one of the motion's sponsors and hopes that UBC will be compelled to act if the vote passes. Ichikawa said, quote, "Certainly our hope is that a university recognizes that it can't cooperate with governance that does not have the confidence of its faculty."
In local news, BC Premier supports university sexual assault policy. The BC Liberal government has decided to support Green Party legislation requiring post-secondary institutions to have sexual assault policies. Last week, Green Party MLA Andrew Weaver introduced the Post-Secondary Sexual Violence Policies Act. The BC Liberals originally rejected the idea. However, Clark says she changed her mind after contemplating high-profile assaults at universities and student activists pushing for campus policies. Clark said for young women in university, quote, "We want them to be safe in what is their first experience away from home, and we can do more to protect them." MLA Weaver said of the change in decision, quote, "I was surprised, and I have no problem saying kudos to the premier on an issue she now says is going to be dealt with." Clark says the Liberals aim to have something passed by the end of the legislative session.
In national news, Northern Ontario First Nation children evacuated. Children in Keshechuan First Nation have developed unusual rashes and painful sores on their bodies. As a result, three children have been evacuated from the community, and another 13 are expected to be removed for examination and treatment. Dr. Gordon Green, one of the three doctors to visit the First Nation, said the issue was, quote, "not really a medical emergency, but a social emergency." No one cause has been determined, but doctors have found cases of eczema and a few suspected cases of scabies. Sanitation in Keshechuan can be a problem, as incomes are low and a regular-sized bottle of laundry soap costs $37 compared to $10 in Toronto. Anishinaabe Aski Nation Grand Chief Alvin Fidler says the government needs to address broader systemic issues in Northern Ontario. Fidler said, quote, We need to look at the longer term, some of the determinants of health, housing, water, and education. Everything else that contributed to the health and well-being of our families.
WestJet denies claims of sexual assault cover-up. WestJet is denying claims by former flight attendant Mandy Lewis that she was sexually assaulted by a pilot 6 years ago. Lewis alleges that the airline protected the pilot and fired her. WestJet has denied the claims, citing 8 warnings, suspensions, and disciplinary actions against her. Lewis said of WestJet's response, quote, "It is a red herring, a full-blown diversion. It is very revealing. The company is washing their hands of what goes on during layovers." WestJet claims the pilot was disciplined and denied privileges, including opportunities to fly on international routes. Lewis made a civil claim earlier this month that she was sexually assaulted by a WestJet pilot during a layover in Maui in January 2010. Lewis says she tried to pursue criminal charges and that Maui police opened an investigation. 14 days after Lewis was fired, she took her allegations to the media. The story has lead activist group Some of Us to call for WestJet WestJet CEO Greg Saretsky to resign. Emma Pullman of the organization said, quote, "We are extremely disappointed to see the inappropriate and adversarial position WestJet is taking in response to a legitimate claim regarding a troubling incident of sexual assault in the workplace."
In international news, Brussels bombing linked to Paris attacks. A member of ISIS involved in Tuesday's attacks in Brussels has been linked through DNA to the Paris attacks. Najim Lashrahawi was one of 2 suicide bombers reskilled that killed 11 people at the Brussels airport. An hour after the airport bombing, another blast struck commuters at a subway station in central Brussels near the European Union headquarters. At least 30 people were killed in total and more than 2,000 wounded. On Tuesday, Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel declared 3 days of national mourning. Michel said, quote, "In this time of tragedy, this black moment for our country, I appeal to everyone to remain calm, but also to show solidarity." The attacks came days after the main suspect in the Paris attacks was arrested. Salah Abdeslam told authorities he had created a new network and was planning new attacks. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Trudeau said, quote, "What happened today in Brussels was an act of terror. It was violence directed at innocent civilians, and its goal was to take lives and instill fear. This cannot and will not be tolerated." Canada's Belgium ambassador, Raoul Delcord, thanked Canada for its support and said, quote, "A country alone cannot effectively fight this scourge, and we know that nothing must prevent us from maintaining our values."
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Canadians are being bought and sold. We can no longer ignore this reality. Each of the 27 million human trafficking victims around the globe has a unique story. 80% of victims are women. 50% are children. This is not only a global injustice, but a local reality. It is happening right now in my community. We are asking you to take action today. Visit endexploitation.com. Get informed and take action. British anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce once said, "Having heard all this, you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know. Only question now is what will you do?" Join us and help eliminate human slavery in Canada.
Night's work well done, and so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pick my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Right now, News 101 co-director Emily Blake's interview with Aaron Goodman about his photo documentary.
Drug use in Vancouver's downtown east side has made headlines for years, but we rarely hear from users themselves about their lives. Aaron Goodman, a faculty member at Kwantlen Polytechnic University in communications and journalism, spent a year photographing long-term heroin users. They were taking part in North America's first heroin-assisted program, a three-year clinical trial in Vancouver through Providence Healthcare. I spoke with Aaron about the project, his three subjects, Cheryl, Johnny, and Marie, and heroin assistance treatment. So you spent a year photographing heroin users in Vancouver. Could you tell me a bit about that?
Well, in a nutshell, yeah, absolutely. I spent over a year creating a photo documentary about three long-term heroin users who were taking part, who are taking part in North America's first heroin-assisted treatment program in the downtown east side, and it's run by Providence Healthcare.
So is that insight or no?
It's a good question, and it's something that's important to clarify right at the outset. Even the Vancouver Sun confused the two, and it's not surprising that the mistake can be made. So Insight is run by Vancouver Coastal Health, and it's a safe injection site. You know, so these are just some of the basics where people can bring in their own drugs and use drugs in a supervised facility. They've given sterile equipment. I'm not sure if that's the correct word. In case there are medical issues, they can be addressed. The science has shown that it's significantly cut down the number of overdoses and deaths in this city. My project focused on participants who were involved in a three-year clinical trial led by Providence Healthcare, which is the organization that runs St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver. And heroin-assisted treatment involves providing pharmacological heroin, the medical ingredient of heroin, to some of the most chronic and vulnerable long-term heroin users who haven't responded to other forms of treatment, such as methadone and detox. So it's important to note that heroin-assisted treatment is science-based, and it's been practiced and offered as part of national healthcare systems across Europe for years in countries such as the UK and Switzerland and beyond. So this trial, first time it was tried in North America. Now the study is over, and the Supreme Court of British Columbia gave the right to Providence Healthcare to continue providing the treatment to, I think, 120 former participants of the clinical trials.
And why did you want to do this project where you're following these people?
I first learned about the heroin-assisted treatment program by attending a documentary screening at Simon Fraser University about a heroin-assisted treatment program in Denmark that had been very successful. And after the screening, there was a panel discussion, and one of the participants of Vancouver's program was on the panel, and I heard him say things such as that it saved a lot of people's lives. It had helped people in the program reclaim their health and get jobs and reconnect with family. Really significant things. So I was really intrigued, and I wanted to know more about how people were benefiting and experiencing this program. At the same time, Canada's former health minister, Rona Ambrose, and the Conservative government were trying to shut the program down. In fact, they did cut off Providence's physicians' rights to offer the treatment for a time, which led five of the participants of the clinical trial to go to BC Supreme Court, as I mentioned, and won the right to continue accessing the treatment. And the language that the former health minister was using and the fact that she was going against the science of Canada's health ministry was quite unsettling to me. I think the important moment for me was when I stumbled across a petition launched by the Conservative government online in which they were using language such as, Canadians need to fight with us to make sure this never happens again. So this language was really a stark contrast to the experiences of the participants themselves, because I was starting to spend a lot of time getting to know them. And again, I was learning firsthand and anecdotally from them that they, many said that the program had helped save their lives. So I wanted to create a photo story that could help amplify the voices of the participants, the people who were benefiting from the program themselves, because I didn't think that their voices were being heard and the dominant messages were coming from the former Conservative government.
And how were you able to get access to these individuals?
Actually, at the documentary screening that I mentioned at SFU, some people from Providence Healthcare were there. And I kind of had a light bulb moment during the screening and panel discussion. And after the discussion, I introduced myself to one person in particular from Providence Healthcare, and we began to chat. And I floated the idea by him that I was interested in creating this photo documentary. And he was interested in learning more, so over the coming days, we continued to talk about it. And ultimately, I was invited to go to the clinic where the treatment is offered. It's the Crosstown Clinic, which was at the corner of Abbott and Hastings Street in the downtown East Side, to meet with some of the participants. And they were informed as well of about the project. And over the next couple of weeks, I met with about 10 of the participants who were interested in meeting with me and learning more about my vision for the project. All of them were interested in taking part, and I chose to collaborate with three of the participants. And I chose them because I wanted to work with people and photograph people who had varied life experiences, who were, as I say, engaging with community and holding down jobs and had secured housing and reconnecting with family, this kind of thing.
Could you maybe tell me a bit more about the three participants?
Johnny, I don't know their exact ages, but Johnny was the oldest of them all. I think he's probably in his late 40s. He had been in jail at least once for petty crime, for shoplifting, in order to support his heroin habit. He needs or needed a new hip. I'm not sure if he's had the operation since the project ended, and had a lot of pain and was using heroin to kind of manage his physical pain that he experienced. Marie was a very interesting person, and when she was a young woman, she was a very talented dancer. And she auditioned for the National Ballet of Canada, but had a number of very serious personal challenges right at the outset, including an abusive, her mother's partner was very abusive, and she was later in a very abusive relationship with a man for about 10 years. And Cheryl worked as a sex worker and lives in the downtown East Side, along with two other individuals, has repeatedly tried to stop using heroin and has been unable to. So that's kind of a brief outline or summary of who the individuals are.
And so this is something you mentioned on Medium, but there have been a lot of different photography projects following heroin users. What makes your project different?
Well, as you know, this is a research project as well as a photo project, and part of the research was to explore the long tradition, as you say, of documentary photography of heroin users, injection drug users, and most of the photography that exists is quite stigmatizing, and the photographs generally exoticize, eroticize, and represent injection drug users as basically as outcasts and as dangerous to society. And the people I met who were participating in the heroin-assisted treatment clinic were nothing like this. They were human beings above all. And Dr. Gabor Mate, who's written about drug users and has worked with drug users in the downtown East Side for decades, has written that trauma is at the heart or at the root of all addiction, whether it's gambling or compulsive shopping or drug use. And that's part of the story that I wanted to communicate. That trauma and hurt was really one of the major contributing factors that led these three people to drug use in the first place and has kept them using. So my objective, in a sense, in a nutshell, was to try to create a new kind of image, a more human, a more balanced image. It was very challenging to do for a number of reasons, but that was my goal.
And there's one quote from Marie that I thought was really interesting. She said, "A needle in my arm is only 10% of who I am."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wanted to represent these people as people. And in fact, their drug use was really low down in terms of my list of priorities. So, for example, with Marie, one of the kind of positive moments I felt was when I managed to follow her or go with her as she tried to find her mom. She hadn't seen her mother in over 2 years, and it was Thanksgiving. And I thought, you know, I thought people could resonate with photos like these, because even though we as viewers might not be able to relate to the depth of Marie's suffering or the nature of her suffering, I thought, well, we all know what it's like to want to spend the holidays with family. We all know what it's like to feel isolated and lonely. So I wanted to try to represent and communicate kind of the universal elements of these people's experiences.
And I thought it was interesting that you showed them the photographs and asked them about them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. And right from the outset of the project, I recognized that the photos on their own wouldn't be able to communicate the full context and the full stories. And Philip Bourgois and Jeffrey Schoenberg, who conducted a 10-year photo-based study of drug users in San Francisco, write that photos can lead to 1,000 deceptions, photos on their own. And Susan Sontag also writes that photos need to be paired with context in order to communicate the truth or the full picture. And particularly in this project, I encountered a lot of challenges, as I say, because two of the three participants or subjects continued to use drugs outside of the heroin-assisted treatment program. And I knew that on their own, these kinds of images might send the signal to viewers that, hey, if heroin-assisted treatment doesn't work, or there's something wrong with it, or we need to scrap it. And so that's why I decided to go back to the subjects and get their impressions of the photos, their feedback, and provide context, because I'm quite sure, and the science points to, that heroin-assisted treatment does work. It's just that it was a double-blind study, and the individuals say they weren't receiving the right drug or enough of the drug in order to satiate their desire or need to substitute with other drugs. For example, there's a photo of Cheryl self-injecting in front of a mirror in her apartment into her neck. On its own, this image or this type of image could be very stigmatizing. But when the viewer hopefully takes the time, and I recognize that there's work involved for the viewer reads Cheryl's own words. What Cheryl says is that, "I have to do this because I'm trying to numb the pain that I feel." And she wants to overcome her addiction, but she can't. So she's trapped. She has to buy illicit street drugs that may be contaminated, that may kill her. And she knows all of this, but she can't get out of this vicious cycle. And she's asking the public to support heroin-assisted treatment program and other harm reduction programs so she can get off the drugs.
Is there anything that you'd like to add?
The photos may be or will likely be exhibited in Vancouver in the coming months, so stay tuned for that if you're interested. And other than that, I hope that the project helps to help amplify the voices of some of the most marginalized and disenfranchised people in our society.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks, Emily.
You can find Aaron's photographs and research at aarongoodman.com and on his Medium account.
Thank you, Emily. Now we have News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph's interview with Cody Zachariah, chairman of the National Aboriginal Caucus for the Canadian Federation of Students. Rohit spoke with Cody about Trudeau's budget reveal and the government's failure to lift the 2% funding cap on the post-secondary student support program for First Nations.
Sego, Rudari, Karagi, Yonda, Kenteke, Kanyan, Kahaga. My name is Cody Zachariah. I'm the chairman for the National Aboriginal Caucus of the Canadian Federation of Students. My role there is to basically advocate for Indigenous student concerns from coast to coast, to coordinate our caucus for meetings and for events throughout the year.
Awesome, Cody. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. So I was just wanting to first get started about this whole funding cap and what it means for students in First Nations communities who are wanting to, get a post-secondary education. What did this funding cap, how did it have an impact on people who wanted to get an education, university or college education?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the PSSSP program, which allocates 2%, it's a 2% cap every year on funding, which the government allocates to First Nation bands.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a cap that's been in place since 1996. So it's an outdated policy. It's very limiting, and the Aboriginal population, or First Nations, or Indigenous, however people choose to identify, is growing at a far more substantial rate than a 2% increase every year. In fact, the Indigenous population is growing at a rate of 6-1 at the rest of Canada. And so what happens with this 2% cap is it doesn't take into account the demographic change. So there's a lot more First Nations youth that are actually wanting to go to school, eligible, trying to seek post-secondary education, and they're being hit with barriers. They're being told that there's just not enough funding, and they're being denied every year. And I even met with IMAC Minister Carolyn Bennett back in February, where we were told, like me and my other executive, N. Bill and Art, who's the chairman or chairperson, were told that this cap was going to be lifted.
Specifically the PSSSP, right?
Yeah, specifically the PSSSP we were told was going to be lifted.
Why do you think this is the case?
Personally, I still think they haven't worked out how they're going to approach it. There's been a lot of promises. I know that there was $50 million that was supposed to be allocated. The new budget says that there's over $8 billion. It's very ambiguous in the wording. It just says that they're going to talk to communities. There's nothing concrete in there. It doesn't mention lifting the cap, which is what they campaigned on. I'm kind of left with this thing of like, yeah, maybe it is another blanket statement. It's nice to see that money is being allocated, but there's still no specifics as to how that's going to impact students in post-secondary education.
What's the next step for the parties involved that want to get rid of this cap and make sure that funding is allocated?
I would say by keeping the awareness. We've already requested a follow-up meeting with the Liberal Party, with INAC Minister Carolyn Bennett. That's been my advocacy role, is actually going into Parliament, meeting with these MPs, and we have our statistics to back up and to show how many students are trying to go to school and being...
I'm writing an article that's basically trying to debunk the stereotype of, First Nations or Aboriginal students getting completely free tuition, which is a stereotype that, I mean, unfortunately, I used to believe. And I feel like it took me actually meeting, Indigenous students at UBC, at UVic actually as well, and in communities. And then hearing that this is like the worst, most annoying thing they've heard is this stereotype in particular. Do you have any personal experience encountering that stereotype and having to explain to people what the reality is, just on a day-to-day kind of thing?
It's funny that you mentioned that, because it almost is day-to-day. I've had to explain to some people, even in my family, how this is not a free ride and not everybody is even accepted. I personally have been denied twice funding to go to school, and I've had to take on a student loan because I didn't want that to stop me from getting an education. Unfortunately, a lot of people, that does stop a lot of people. But yeah, there's this notion that everybody is just getting free money, and that's just simply not true. Since 2008, I believe over 200,000 students have been denied funding. I think a lot of people are told that lie, and that's like a division between non-Indigenous Canadians and Indigenous who feel like we're just getting things for free. When in fact a lot of Canada's wealth comes from resource extraction on First Nations land. So to me, I see some sort of partnership or something going on there, but it's the other end of the treaty is not being held up. Mm-hmm. Education is a treaty right.
Why do you think it is especially important for First Nations, Aboriginal students to be getting this access? Why do you personally feel so invested in this?
Well, I personally feel so invested because I am an Indigenous person. I know what it's like to not access these services, and I've grown up being systemically oppressed, to be honest. I mean, a lot of First Nations community come from impoverished situations. They come from families who have been traumatized from the residential school system, so they don't really have that legacy of funding or those, you know, those parents that can afford to send these students to school. You know, so there's a lot of trauma in the First Nations community, and I think now there's a lot of youth that are trying to escape that trauma and go after and get an education and give themselves the life that unfortunately their parents may not have been able to have.
Mm-hmm.
So I see this as, like, you know, it's almost economic development. If we have more people in society that are educated, that are healthy, and that are getting good jobs, isn't that good for Canada as a whole?
Absolutely, yeah. And, I mean, in particular, university or college, do you think, why do you think that route is an especially powerful way of, you know, exactly of what you just said, of actually developing the community and also fighting against, you know, systemic racism?
I think education is a huge factor. I think in the Canadian education system right now, at the high school level and the elementary, where, you know, school is basically, or it's a lot more accessible, it's free, these things aren't just, they're not being taught. Indigenous history, you get like maybe one project, or we talk about Louis Riel.
Yeah, that's literally what, yeah, you're dead on. You're, even here in BC, it's the same thing.
Right. So for me, it took until post-secondary education to actually learn about a lot of real Indigenous reality and to learn about, you know, some real history.
Even for you as an Indigenous person?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's funny because I had to, like, pay. Yeah, like, they stole my history and then I had to go pay to get it back. I have to pay to go learn my language. I have to pay to, I mean, there is some programming, but it's the majority of the concrete ones are in those institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think it's important for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit youth to have access to those education institutions.
What do you think, you know, non-Indigenous folks can do? Like, I mean, I'm not talking about government. I mean, people that want to help and support and actually fight, you know, fight this fight with you. What would you recommend they do?
I would recommend, like, students in school can talk to, or can, you know, find out if there's an Indigenous space on your campus. Maybe there's some sort of council there, or just some youth you can go talk to. Maybe there's an elder. You know, there's ways that you can start interacting with people on a more wholesome level than these harmful stereotypes. Because once you're there, once you're accepted, you can humanize. You know, you don't see people as, you know, quote unquote free riders of the Canadian system. You can learn about the systemic problems that got them there. And also you might learn some history that's beautiful that you didn't know was there. I think that's been one of the most rewarding things when I've had, like, newcomer non-Indigenous friends. You know, we can see similarities in each other's stories. Colonization didn't start in North America. So I find when I talk to newcomer youth about that, we almost share a certain similarity in our stories. In colonization. So once we start to look at each other through a different lens, I think we can have healthier relationships.
All right.
Be in touch.
All right. Thank you so much, Cody. It was really nice to talk to you, and I really.
Thank you, Rohit. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
You're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Do you like Friends? Well, we like you, so become a member and get a Friends of CITR card. Not only does it make you special, but it gets you all kinds of deals with our friends at UBC and the West Side, like Australian Boot Company, Dentry's Pub, The Bike Kitchen, Limelight Video, and more. Visit CITR.ca for more, or come check us out in the Nest.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have our discussion panel on the Gion Gomeshi verdict.
Thank you, Sam and Eva. This is Rohith Joseph, co-director of News 101, and we also have my fellow co-director, Emily Blake, joining us, and a very special guest is joining us in the studio, my former mentor from the Arts Report, Sarah Lapsley. Can you introduce yourself to the good people?
Hi, thank you. I'm Sarah. I'm here to talk about the Gion Gomeshi case. I work as a counselor in correctional mental health, so I did my master's here at UBC. So I work with clients who have perpetrated crimes, and so a lot of this kind of issues are familiar to me. So it was very interesting and a lot of food for thought.
Mm-hmm.
So I was excited to come talk about it.
So what made you particularly invested in wanting to talk about it, the Gion Gomeshi case?
I think partially I'm just interested in crime. So I like to read about it and think about it and sort of analyze it. From a psychological standpoint, Gomeshi is a complicated person, I think a predatory and dangerous person. I've done a lot of reading about psychopathy and narcissism, and one of the world's experts on psychopathy and narcissism, Robert Hare, actually is from UBC, and so I read a lot about people like this in our midst and how to avoid them and how to see them. So I have a special interest really in psychological self-defense, in terms of how to avoid people like this. And I recently had a boss who was similar to Gomeshi in character and was involved in the whole process of bringing this person, you know, to light. And it was a very difficult experience. So I definitely have sympathy for the difficulty, you know, in dealing with people like this. So he's definitely an exploitive, abusive person. And I was actually unpleasantly surprised by the results of the trial yesterday.
Before we get into the results, and we're going to open the floor at that point for a discussion, why don't you just kind of briefly tell listeners, catch them up on what's been happening with the Gion Gomeshi case?
Yeah, well, it just sort of broke in, I guess, November 2014 with this Facebook post, sort of a preemptive Facebook post where he claimed that angry ex-girlfriends were bringing these false allegations against him. I felt it was like a very bizarre, hysterical post, and then it sort of exploded in terms of being fired from the CBC. And then all these things came to light about his past history of very concerning, disreputable behavior, a bully, exploitive, sexually aggressive and assaultive. I think up to 23 women and one man alleged that he had hit them in the course of like an interpersonal interaction. And there were rumors from his student days that he hit students as well. When he was still active at the CBC, university journalism program said, no, he can't, like, don't send your students to his program, because so it was known, but none of it was coming to light. And so five charges stuck And that's the original trial. And there's actually still an outstanding charge. He's going to trial again in June with another individual who's bringing charges against him. But what was interesting about this was that, you know, when the judge in his findings, so he found Giancomeschi not guilty, he really laid out a framework of analysis, how he came to his decision. And it was really interesting. So, you know, this idea of presumption of innocence, sort of the basic presumption in a criminal proceedings, is that the accused is innocent until proven guilty. And then, so of course, the proof has to be provided beyond a reasonable doubt. And so his judgment was reasonable considering what happened in the trial. Unfortunately, the case was lost. You know, he sort of points out in his findings that it's essentially sort of, in especially historical cases like this, it's sort of two people's words against one another. And that so there's the only evidence really is the word of the victim. And so then the credibility of the accuser has to be established. Unfortunately, the three individuals that brought the charges against him really engaged in some misconduct, worrisome misconduct in the trial. So false memory in the one case. Lucy de Couture was involved in like just so many inconsistencies in her stories, withholding information. And the third one was sort of accused of playing chicken with the justice system. I'm only going to tell half the truth until I'm pressed into sort of revealing the rest of it. So their conduct in the courtroom was so concerning that, you know, he just decided there's no proof here that the case really relied on the veracity of what they said. And because they withheld information, and he even went as far to say things outright deception. I mean, and that's potentially could lead to opening themselves up to countersuits from Gomeshi. Their conduct was really, really questionable. And in particular, this sort of collusion that they did with people in court cases aren't supposed to correspond with each other. And they did correspond with each other and really was apparent, you know, they wanted to bring him down. They were a team. They wanted to bring him down. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that feeling. Like, part of the scandal and the sense of betrayal was, here's this guy who everybody looked up to, right? He's this feminist guy, nice guy, like, you know, sort of liberal guy, but it was a sham. And his behavior is angering and really wrong. But, you know, the judge sort of said, you know, their only job was to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And they actually didn't do that. They became consumed with bringing him down instead of consumed with just laying the story out in a factual way. So I hope the next trial goes better in terms of they're able to. I think if the witnesses had made had better conduct in the court, I think that some of the charges would have stuck. These are very serious charges, and he's guilty of them. I don't think there's any question about that. One thing the judge did say that I found slightly upsetting, you know, and this speaks to a lot of the discourse that's happening right now just around the unfairness in society and how difficult it is to report sexual assaults and so on. He said, each complainant engaged in conduct regarding Mr. Gomeshi after the fact, which seemed out of harmony with the assaultive behavior ascribed to him. So he's saying, you know, the women claimed he assaulted them, and then they wrote him and said, you know, they were in love with him or wanted to continue the relationship or send him sexy pictures. And I think that's something that everyone can see as what's called a trauma bond, right? Or it's a very typical response to abusive treatment. And so it's known as a betrayal bond or a trauma bond, where being abused actually can lead people to seek out the abuser even more, that a bond is created that's incredibly painful and destructive, but very, very powerful. In that sense, I felt the judge made that statement a couple of times, and I felt like he was on thin ice on that a little bit, like, and maybe just out of touch You know, he is sort of like the older white guy judge. But overall, I think his decision was sound in terms of based on presumption of innocence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It wasn't there. So it's just a tragic turn of events in general, I think. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. Let's open up this discussion. Emily, why don't we get your take on the results and if you feel like hitting on some of Sarah's points, agreement, disagreement, feel free.
Sure. So I had a lot of thoughts and feelings when the case came out. And for me, I spent 2 years volunteering an organization called Women in Crisis in Guelph, Ontario, which they're quite similar to WAVA, Women Against Violence Against Women, here in Vancouver. I've been following the Gumeshi case quite closely since November, so that's kind of my background. And I look at this case in kind of two different ways. There's from the legal aspect, and then there's from my experience in sort of seeing, you know, how different systems treat survivors of sexual assault, whether it be, you know, the media, the courts, the legal system. And, you know, legally it does seem, in this case, there just wasn't enough proof beyond a reasonable doubt to convict Gumeshi. I really wasn't surprised when the verdict came out. I was kind of suspecting it beforehand, but I think it also speaks to the fact that the legal system really isn't set up to properly deal with sexual assault allegations. And, you know, you look at some of the things the judge said. He made a statement about how we should try to resist the assumption that all sexual assault complainants are true, when in fact that really isn't the case. I mean, anytime I've talked to people about sexual assault cases, I think their immediate reaction is, well, don't women lie about these things, when that's never the reaction to other types of violent crimes. And in fact, false sexual assault accusations are extremely low. Sexual assault is actually extremely underreported compared to other different types of crimes. And yeah, the system is just not set up to deal with it properly, I don't think.
You had mentioned that sexual assaults are consistently underreported. Is that something that you found, is this data you've managed to look at in Canada, or like, is this kind of a common trend all over?
Well, in Canada, they say it's under 10%, and that's based on different studies. Some suggest that it's even lower. So that's at least 90% of cases that aren't being reported. And from my personal experience of speaking to survivors, a lot of them don't report. And there's lots of different reasons. And it's because the legal system isn't set up to properly handle them. It might just be their word against someone else's. The whole legal system can be very re-traumatizing because they have to retell their stories. They often have to face their accuser. They often have to face public scrutiny over whether they're telling the truth or not. You look at the way these women were treated by the defense lawyer, how they were kind of sort of raked over the coals, and everything that they said was really challenged, which is understandable in a legal case, but you can understand how a survivor of sexual assault isn't going to want to go through that.
Mm-hmm. Eva, what are your thoughts on the legal system and its handling of sexual assault?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with Emily, especially in terms of how the witnesses were treated by the defense attorney. And in this case, you really come out of it at the end having the impression that it was the witnesses that were put on trial and not Gumeshi. And I think that it's fair to say that that's going to discourage victims of sexual assault from coming forward in the future. And one of the things that's really standing out to me after this decision is people, you know, are saying the judge probably made the right call given the evidence he had before him. And a lot of people saying, you know, if they had just told the truth from the beginning, this wouldn't have been an issue. And I think that's absolutely not true.
Why is that?
Well, I think if that they had come out from the beginning and said, oh, yeah, Gian Gumeshi assaulted me, but I continued to send him emails after on and to try to pursue a relationship, this case probably wouldn't have moved forward to trial at all. Public opinion would have, you know, would have been against them from the get-go. So I really, I don't think it's hard to understand why they might have felt extremely apprehensive about sharing some of these details, because people don't understand exactly how victims of sexual assault react after that. So I don't think it's fair to say if they had just told the whole truth from the beginning that this wouldn't have been a problem and we would have seen them as more credible.
Although, I mean, Sarah Lapsley had brought up that there was like we are, I think, in a time, at least in Canada, I can't say globally, we are in a time where we're a little bit more understanding. We have heard of Sarah, you called it trauma bonds. I mean, or something similar like Stockholm syndrome, where you end up being, you know, in contact with the, whether it be an abuser or a kidnapper, mm-hmm. right? So, but then again, it's a question of whether the media, how they portray that, because you can mention that, yes, there is a real thing called trauma bonds. There is a real condition called Stockholm syndrome, where you end up still maintaining a relationship with the...
Yeah. I don't know if that's common knowledge, though.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's something that people generally accept and are aware of.
Perhaps it's the media's responsibility to make that the case?
Yeah, maybe. And people just should, you know, make themselves aware of it, too. But I think... Yeah, one thing to remember, too, is we say, okay, John Gomeshi was not convicted in court, but the court of public opinion has found him guilty.
Mm.
And that wasn't the case at first when the story first broke. After the first few days after he made the Facebook statement, the public was divided. A lot of people stood up for him, including, you know, people who worked with him at CBC, musical artists that worked with him. It wasn't until, you know, just the sheer numbers of women came forward and Lucie Ducoutre put her name to her accusation that public opinion, you know, turned against him. So I think, you know, it's hard to say that he's kind of learned his lesson from that, you know, he's been convicted in the court of public opinion as well, because, you know, people think he'll never work again in media again, but I don't think that's true either.
Emily, you had something to add?
Yeah, there was an article that came out recently, right before the verdict, and it was a few different PR experts said that they really think that Gomeshi can improve his public image, if you will, and will work in media again, especially the fact that he's been acquitted. And I think also, you know, this case has really been a national example, and it's really said, you know, if you're a sexual assault survivor, you're probably not going to get, you know, believed. You're probably not going to get a conviction. And I think it's going to discourage even more people from speaking out.
Hmm. What do you think of that, Sam? You've been quiet, brooding in the background here.
Do you think
there's any... what do you think of this idea of this court case setting a precedent for sexual assault survivors to not come out, perhaps?
I mean... I don't know that it sets a precedent. I think that it confirms a precedent that's basically already existed. Like, mm-hmm. like we've got this problem, and this is just, you know, it's one more thing where, you know, it's you know, emblematic of a problem that already exists. It's not breaking new ground in that mm-hmm. sense. I would add to the court of public opinion thing that, like, the court of public opinion has a very short memory. People still go to watch Woody Allen's movies. And still go to, they still smile when Remix to Ignition comes on. You know, like
R. Kelly.
R. Kelly's music. You know, like you can be in, like, really just terrible, like you could be associated with really terrible things. And, you know, give it 10 years, give it 20 years. You know, there will be a whole new generation of people to admire the things that you've done that have never heard of the bad things that you've done.
Well, look at Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
30 years ago, he was accused of what's finally, you know, coming
exactly.
to light now.
And that didn't even really get addressed until some stand-up comedian. I think it was Hannibal Buress who like brought it up as a gag, as a punchline to one of his jokes. And that sort of like kicked the whole thing off again. Like... people forget really easily about this stuff, sort of as a society. There's always going to be people who remember it, but like in terms of the sort of like mass culture, that kind of thing, like people forget way, way easier than we probably should. So like I don't know exactly where I'm going with this. But
how about
like,
we do have to wrap it up, guys. So I think let's end on like maybe just one comment from each of you of what do you think perhaps since we're all like at least four of us here are involved in the media, What should the media take away from this? What can we do, better or improve as a result of, from this? Because this has been a media circus from 2 years, almost 2 years ago now. So, yeah, how about we start with Sam here, and then we'll go and end with Sarah.
I mean, I think a really important thing to take from how this is all sort of shaken out is, like, not to take, people as either they're telling the truth or they're lying. Like, there are going to be inconsistencies with this stuff, and to understand that in how you report it. Like, this is not – it's not a simple cut and dry, this person is either making everything up or they're telling the truth about everything. Like, something might – there are going to be inconsistencies, and like understanding that moving forward, I think is a really important step, especially with the case in June. Like, I'm really curious to see how this affects the case that they build when that goes to trial. Mm-hmm. Because obviously there are lessons to take from this for both sides.
Okay. And Eva?
Yeah, well, something that I found really interesting that relates to media is something Charlie Angus, an NDP MP, said. And he said that one of the things he learned from this is that Gian flourished as a predator in what should have been the safest organization in the country. And I thought that was really interesting because you're surrounded by journalists. You would think that that would be a safe environment. You'd think that those would be the people that as soon as they kind of get a hint of something going on, that gets investigated further. So I hope that this means that the journalism community will be more wary of this in the future. And I get worried when we're idolizing people like this when, that's not really the job of journalists. So that's my take on that.
Emily?
Yeah, I agree. I hope that it has a positive effect on how media covers these types of stories. I know Femifesto came out with this big report on how journalists should report about sexual assault allegations and survivors, which is an amazing resource. And I think all the statistics and knowledge is coming out, and there's really no excuse for people to be ignorant about it anymore, I don't think.
All right, Sarah, you get the last word.
No, I think it's been a really interesting conversation. I think, what's important is that we just keep talking about it. And we're fortunate with social media and all kinds of alternative media that everyone does have an opportunity to sort of say what they think. This is now, people are raising their voices. It's getting talked about. Everyone has, different opinions. But what results from that is sort of a growth and moving forward. Frameworks, the legal system is sort of a behemoth that's not going to change. It's not perfect, but it works, right? We're trying to protect all parties involved in a lawsuit. So I think it's, how can we provide better protections to people that have been victims of any